Welcome to the 853 OKG podcast. I am your host, Philip Sumner. So what's been going on the last 6 months since I last talked at you? Obviously, the world has changed quite dramatically since then. It's been weird. It's been scary. It's been frustrating. I hope things are about to start heading the right way, although it doesn't really look like that's happening yet. But I hope that you and yours are safe and healthy. Something that's kind of helped me get through the pandemic, and this is kind of the new normal, that's what people keep saying. It's, you know, something's provided me comfort and stuff like that is nostalgia. Kind of thinking about the good old days, you know, thinking about summers when I was a kid and, you know, the stuff in the 70s and 80s. And, one of those things obviously is television and watching old TV shows that I used to like to watch and, you know, shows that made me feel good. You know, shows like Adam 12 and Andy Griffith and Barney Miller and Maverick and, of course, The Rockford Files. So, you know, that kind of helped me get through it. I don't know what helped you. Maybe you guys have something that helps you get through this time of, in some cases, for some people, isolation, whether you're with your family or isolated from your family, it's tough either way. Something that just happened that's actually some sort of good news is the Rockford Files is now available on another streaming platform. The new Peacock streaming platform from NBC Universal has the entire run of the Rockford Files. So that's another way you can watch it, which is pretty cool. If you don't have Amazon Prime, and a lot of people don't because it costs like $100 a year, you can get in on the Peacock thing. And right now, I think if you just have a cable subscription of some kind, you can log in. I was able to get in and I don't even remember what I did. I think I created a login and that was it. But they have a lot of shows on the Peacock, including Dateline, which I enjoy watching with Keith Morrison doing some very fun reaction shots in all the interviews he does. That's another thing that got me through the pandemic is watching Keith Morrison do funny reaction shots. He can make a grisly murder somehow seem fun, and I don't know how he does that. It's very weird. Anyway, we are here to talk about the Rockford Files. Welcome to all of our new listeners. Some of you were original viewers of the Rockford Files back in the day. Some of you are younger folks who somehow found the Rockford Files on one streaming platform or another, or maybe even your parents' DVD collection. Welcome to all of you. Let's get started now in a moment. I say now. What I mean is we're going to take a very quick break, but let's get started with season one, episode two, The Dark and Bloody Ground. It is the 853 OKG podcast. Welcome back. That was some of the finest 1970s rock and roll that was free to use, royalty-free music. That's not too bad. It sort of sounds a little bit like the Rockford Files theme in that there's a guitar playing. You know, royalty-free, man. We got to do what we can do to make it by. Kind of digging that song though. That I actually might go in my my iPhone just to play in my car because that's pretty rock. Let me just pull that down there. It's just gonna go on forever. Anyway, welcome to the 853 OKG podcast. So I said that before, but I'm gonna say it again. The Dark and Bloody Ground is the episode we're talking about today. It aired originally on September 20th, 1974. Of course, that was a Friday night. It aired on NBC between Chico and the Man and a policewoman. That whole NBC Friday night lineup in that time period, in those the early to mid 70s, starting with Sanford and Son at the top, all the way through, you know, Chico and the Man and Rockford, and then Policewoman. That was solid. I mean, those shows were all good, and they gave you really no reason to have to get off of your couch or get out of your easy chair to go and literally change the channel on your television. On your console TV at that point. During the same time period, or the same airing period that night, ABC was showing the $6 million man, which I had the doll. I'm sorry. I had the action figure. It's totally an action figure and not a doll because you could look through the back of his head and see something. I can't remember how that worked. And then CBS was showing the second episode of the TV series Planet of the Apes with Roddy McDowell. I don't know about you, but I would much rather watch an episode of The Rockford Files than either of those other shows. Although when I was a kid, I was really into the $6 million man. I will give you that. Of course, the Dark and Bloody Ground is the name of this episode, and we do end up with a dead body, actually a couple, in this episode, but neither of them are bloody, which is, you're like, so, you know, why is it called the Dark and Bloody Ground? We find that out later. The corpse in this episode actually dies in a fire. That's how the show kind of gets rolling, with fire trucks, rushing to an apartment fire. First of all, this is obviously stock footage because it's nighttime when these fire trucks are rolling out with their lights and sirens on. And then we immediately cut to midday when the fire is put out and they're wheeling the corpse out of the apartment. This frantic woman comes running up out of nowhere. She wasn't driving. Maybe she was on a bus. We don't know. She just comes running up from the parking lot to the scene, and she immediately knows that something has happened in her one apartment, and it's the only apartment that's burned in this apartment complex. The police are having to hold her back. She wants to get through, and then they pull the dead guy out, and they take the cover back, and she screams no. The dead guy, to me, looks a lot like Richard Branson, strangely. He does look like Richard Branson. He does not look like a guy who's been in a fire by any stretch. There's no like soot on his face or anything. He just looks like a guy who's actually literally taking a nap at this moment. But this lady yells no, and then we immediately cut to Jim at his trailer, and he yells no right after. This time he's trying to get Beth Davenport, his attorney, is trying to get him to take on a pro bono case, which it turns out is for the woman from the previous scene. That is her new client. She's been arrested on suspicion of basically killing her husband. Of course, Jim doesn't want to do it because it's free. He works for free a lot, even though he's not intending to. He almost never gets paid. And by the way, Beth Davenport is played by the wonderful Gretchen Corbett. She ends up in a bunch of episodes of The Rockford Files, and she's been in a lot of other things too. And we're going to see her a lot more as things go on in this series. Beth asks Jim, "Don't you even care if she's innocent?" And he says, "Beth, I was in prison 5 years. While I was there, I never met anyone who wasn't innocent." Saying that basically, yeah, they all say that. Everybody says they're innocent. This is just very early on, though. Classic banter between the two of them. That's going to even develop more over future episodes when Corbett guest stars. But the character of Beth does play really well off of Jim Rockford. You know, she also adds another thing to the show, which is to kind of be a recurring female lead for a few episodes along the way. So it's not always just Jim having to play off of a female client, for instance, or some other female. It will give at least some sort of a female lead over the stretch of, or over the run of the show for him to play off of. And the banter like that is very good, very well written, and very well acted between Gretchen Corbett and James Garner. Totally classic stuff, and is really, the, in my opinion, the way they interact with each other is the best part of this episode, bar none. So, of course, Jim agrees to take the case because otherwise we have 44 pages of script with nothing but Jim fishing on the beach, and that's obviously not a show. So, by the way, can you actually catch anything fishing on the beach, like right on the beach like that in that really shallow water? I'm not a fisherman. I have no idea. If you fish on the beach, tweet us a picture of your fish at 853OKGPodcast on Twitter and hashtag fish like Jim. Let's get fish like Jim trending. Is that how you social media? I think so. At least that's what it said on Ask Jeeves. So anyway, Jim agrees to meet with the client. She's crying, and Jim, she cries when Jim tells her that, you know, I didn't agree to take the case. I just agreed to listen to you and see what your story is. So he does decide to dig a little bit deeper, as Jim does. Jim you know, it always kind of turns out, well, I don't know if I want this, but let me dig into it. And then he starts digging deeper and deeper. And that happens in this episode. He goes to see Becker at the police station, and the LAPD has closed this case because basically they think they got their woman in this case. They think they have the murderer. Becker tells Jim that the police have closed the case because the coroner says he was smothered before he died. Obviously, you're smothered before you died. He was smothered with his lungs not taking any smoke, so he was smothered before the fire was set. It wasn't just a fire. He wasn't just someone who fell asleep smoking a cigarette. This person was murdered, and then a cigarette put in his hand, and then the apartment set on fire. Jim reminds him, though, that there's really nothing tying the wife to the murder. And what he's really trying to do, Jim, in this case, and Becker knows this and even says so, he's trying to get the police to reopen the case to look into this so he doesn't have to do it himself, because he knows he's not going to get paid. He knows Beth's not going to pay him. She can promise him his $200 a day plus expenses. There's no way she's going to fork over that money. He knows it, and he's doing it anyway. The next scene, Jim is having lunch with Beth in a restaurant. And if you want, you can actually sit in pretty much the same spot. It's a different restaurant now, but it is still a restaurant. Although with COVID and all that, you got to wait. I don't know how that's going, but when this is over, and let's hope this is over at some point, if we make it through this, and we will, you can go to that restaurant. It's actually called the Malibu Farm Restaurant on the Malibu Pier. And you can actually sit in that, that little, area. It's obviously not the same place anymore. The dark wood has been replaced with white paint and everything, but it's the same place. So you can go there if you want. Anyway, they're having lunch, and Jim is putting hot sauce on everything and belching, and it's a fun little scene. Beth agrees, ostensibly, to pay his expenses if he takes the case. So Jim heads off to Arizona to kind of look into this, because this woman owns some land in Arizona. So he's kind of, I guess she moved from Arizona. So he's kind of digging into that a little bit. So he's got to go to Arizona for this, and this is adding up those expenses. And he did fly, because he flies back later. So he rents himself a blue Chevy Vega, lovely, lovely automobile. This scene is supposed to be in a town called, I forgot, I wrote it down. It's Parker or something, Arizona. It's actually shot in, of course, California, shot in Palmdale, California, which is north of Los Angeles. It's got desert, it's got mountains, and it kind of looks like Arizona, sort of. I mean, it looks enough like Arizona that when you're watching TV, you think, oh, maybe he isn't actually in Arizona. So he does some digging around. We don't really see what he's digging into on the screen, but we see he's doing things, and he's getting some information. And as he starts to kind of head back or leave this town, the next scene is highly inspired by the TV movie Duel. I don't know if you've seen that. It was a Steven Spielberg television movie in 1971, starring Dennis Weaver, who is awesome. I mean, Dennis Weaver is like one of my other favorite television actors of all time. He's really good in Duel. So if you haven't seen Duel, it's about a big rig who is basically terrorizing this motorist on the highway, on long stretches of desert highway. And so that's exactly what happens in the very next scene. Now, this show was 1974. Duel came out in 1971. So this is, I would just say, an homage. It's an homage to Duel. And it takes place somewhere out in the Arizona desert. Now, the Chevy Vega, obviously, eventually has enough juice, just enough power to get away from this big rig, because it can't maneuver as quickly as the Vega can. And this actually takes a good amount of screen time, this chase, which is, again, as I've mentioned in previous episodes, it's great for a writer, because you can just write in a car chase and you can fill some time, and gives you time to catch your breath and not literally have to write, you know, the full, whatever is 44 full minutes of dialogue to fill an episode. And we're going to see another car chase later. So it worked out pretty well for Steve and Jay Cannell. This chase does take up a lot of screen time. Several minutes go by with no dialogue, but it is a pretty well edited car chase. A lot of good sound effects, a lot of action shots. You know, it's fun. Eventually, Jim gets away by going over some little bridge in the Vega that the truck can't get through. And he ends up getting to like an old gas station on a highway, and he has to like rough up the attendant to give him a dime so he can call the highway patrol. Turns out the highway patrol says, hey, you know, the truck is stolen. We have no idea who the driver was. We have really no way to find out who the driver was. Sorry, you almost got killed by this truck, but there's nothing we can do. Obviously, Jim is nonplussed by this information, but he ends up flying back to Los Angeles, and then he's back in the Firebird, baby. Finally, back in the Firebirds. First time we see the Firebird in this show. Beth joins him in the Firebird, and wouldn't you know it, someone's cut the brake lines. This seemed to happen a lot in the 1970s and 80s, if you go by television. People were always getting their brake lines cut. Is it that easy to cut someone's brake lines? I know nothing about cars. According to Jim, someone has loosened the fitting on the master cylinder, whatever that means. I assume that's bad. You don't want a loose master cylinder fitting, I'm assuming, because you could almost run over some construction workers and then run into a very convenient pile of gravel that stops your car. Anyway, back in Arizona, Jim found out that his client's husband, who he said wasn't who he said he was. He had assumed a false identity. And before the murder, Ann Calhoun, that's the client's name, that's the woman who has been arrested, went to a party with her now deceased husband, Kevin Calhoun. And it turns out they actually crashed the party at this, this rich couple's house. So the party they crashed was being thrown by Elizabeth Gorman and Clyde Russell. Now, it turns out they have something to do with a movie called The Dark and Bloody Ground. Now we're getting somewhere, right? That's the title of this episode. So we're starting to figure something out. And according to Beth, The Dark and Bloody Ground film is the biggest thing since Birth of a Nation, which I find hard to believe because there's been a lot of huge movies since Birth of a Nation, considering that was a really, really long time ago. I don't know, Gone with the Wind, Wizard of Oz, this, that, a lot of big movies. But this is the biggest thing since Birth of a Nation. In the show, Birth of a Nation, we're done talking about that. In the show, The Dark and Bloody Ground is based on a book. In real life, there have been actually a couple of books with similar titles that have Dark and Bloody Ground in the title. All of them are from the 90s or 2000s. So it's either a coincidence or we have some Rockford fans out there writing shows or writing books rather with the title of the Rockford episode in it. The book in this episode is written by someone with the last name Gorman. It's actually Stephen Gorman, related to Elizabeth Gorman, maybe? Elizabeth Gorman is the one of the producers along with Clyde Russell of this movie, The Dark and Bloody Ground. That's interesting. File that away for later. Jim tells Beth he needs to let the police know about this info he's found, that Kevin Calhoun has set up this false identity and all this. Beth, of course, doesn't like that idea. She says it's an unwritten law. You don't have to turn over info to the police that you obtained while working for the defense. She wants Jim to find out why Calhoun assumed his false identity. Jim's not really buying this unwritten law stuff. There is no such thing as an unwritten law, which is true. She's just trying to convince him to do that. He actually wants to talk to another lawyer, which I think she's kind of insulted by. Anyway, when we come back, we're going to talk about the rest of The Dark and Bloody Ground. We'll be right back. Stick with us. All right, everybody, welcome back. We're going to finish talking about The Dark and Bloody Ground, Season 1, Episode 2 of The Rockford Files. Let's get right back into it. The next act, starting after that commercial break for the show and for our show, starts out at Santa Anita Racetrack. Gorman and Russell, we talked about them earlier. They're the ones who produced this film, The Dark and Bloody Ground. They're also the host of the party that the Calhouns crashed. They're out there at the Santa Anita Racetrack watching the ponies run in a little trackside cafe called Clocker's Corner, which is an actual thing, and it's still a thing at Santa Anita. So there's that. Jim pretends when he bumps into these people, that he was at their party. He's trying to kind of get some info out of them and kind of feel them out a little bit. They claim they didn't know Calhoun at all. And then there's this guy there who works for Gorman and Russell, who claims, you know, I was in charge of the guest list and, you know, nobody crashed this party. So, and Jim kind of pushes him on that. So you're saying that, Calhoun did not crash the party. And he says, well, I didn't say that. And the, you know, even Gorman and Russell said, we don't know this guy. The guy obviously crashed the party. Either you know him and invited him or you don't know him. Later, Beth shows up at Rockford's trailer. He says, you know, she says she found out who killed Calhoun. She says it's Clyde Russell. She says he's involved in copyrights. You know, apparently when a company buys the rights to a book and then it comes time to renew the copyright, if the author is deceased, the company no longer owns the copyright on that property. It goes back to like the next of kin, which in this case is the widow of the writer, which was, wait for it, Elizabeth Gorman. Yes, Elizabeth Gorman, who is the other producer of the movie, was originally the wife of the writer of The Dark and Bloody Ground. See, it's all kind of coming together now in this second little part of the show. Well, it's actually, we're way past halfway at this point. We're in the final stretch, pun intended, with Santa Anita. We're in the final stretch of the show where we sort of kind of put this together and that together, and we still don't even quite know what's going to happen. So then Clyde Russell calls Jim on the phone right when he's speaking to Beth. And he's, it looks to me like he's been drinking, first of all, but he says he wants to talk face to face with Rockford about Kevin Calhoun. He wants Jim to meet him at his house, gives him the address. Jim and Beth go up there, but when they walk up, they can't find Russell. And they go, oh, he's not here. Oh, well, he's here. He's just not alive. He's floating face down in the swimming pool right now. So he's dead. Body number two. Jim is pulling him out of the pool, getting him up on the deck. Him and Beth are standing there, and then all of a sudden they're getting shot at. There's gunshots like whizzing by. So the assailant takes off in a white car, and then Jim gives chase. Turns out this Elliot Malcolm guy, who's the guy who was in charge of the party guest list, and as we see, also the guy who was driving the big rig out in Arizona, trying to duel Jim Rockford in the Vega. So the car chase ensues, the second car chase of this episode. This also takes up a nice little chunk of time in the show. You don't have to worry about dialogue. Another well-edited scene. This is a nighttime car chase. So it looks cool because you can always throw in random edits of lights just flashing in front of the, you know, like car lights, car headlights flashing in front of the camera and, you know, obscuring your view. So it's another well done car chase. And then essentially, Elliot Malcolm. That's right. Elliot Malcolm ends up crashing the car. And to me, it looks like he's dead, but it turns out Jim just tells Beth that, well, he was messed up pretty bad, but he had a watch on that was coming off. It wasn't just a watch, you know, when they showed his body there bloody, his watch had come loose. So it was very noticeable. So obviously we don't see it, but we find out later Jim has taken that watch. So Jim wants to go talk now to Elizabeth Gorman, the producer of the Dark and Bloody Ground movie and the wife of the writer of the book. He tells her Elliot's been charged with the murder of Kevin Calhoun. He says Elliot is telling the police everything. I think Jim's really trying. I don't think that's really happened. Obviously, we know it hasn't happened. Jim knows this woman killed her ex-husband. He's trying to get her to say it by saying that Elliot, who he knows she's, you know, in love with, based on the inscription on the watch that Elliot was wearing, he's trying to get her to confess because he knows she did it. He's trying to say, hey, Elliot's taking the fall for you. He's telling the police this and this and this. Rockford has figured out that the writer of The Dark and Bloody Ground was in fact Kevin Calhoun. Kevin Calhoun's real name was Stephen Gorman. So he kind of showed up after he said, hey, there's this movie. There's all this money being made from it. I wrote this book. I'm showing up. I'm going to try to get myself some of that money. And Elizabeth killed him. She killed him because, one, the money, obviously. She killed him because she's mad he faked his death because he was, you know, too scared to ask her for a divorce, which that is kind of a, it's kind of a crazy thing. I mean, just get the divorce, dude. I mean, seriously, it's a lot of trouble to go through to fake your death, for crying out loud. So that's basically it. That's how the show ends. Elizabeth, says she killed him, and then, that's the end of that. Overall though, a good episode, well written. Stephen J. Cannell, wrote it. It was directed by Michael Schultz, who later went on to direct the movie Cooley High, the movie Car Wash. Michael Schultz is still directing TV to this day. He's 82 years old and he's still directing episodic TV. He's directed some episodes of Blackish. He's directed, I know, at least one episode of the TV show Manifest and a lot of other shows. He's still working. He's 82 years old. You can attribute that to one, he's really good and he really enjoys what he's doing, or two, maybe the union just doesn't have as good health insurance when for retirees. I don't know. But I mean, he's obviously still directing like big time network television shows. So that's good for him. You know, it's a hell of a career. If you look at Michael Schultz's IMDb page, it's pretty impressive. Stephen J. Cannell, of course, prolific, but he was really kind of starting to come into his own as a writer at this point in his career. He had been writing television for like 3 years, a lot of episodes of Adam 12 and a lot of other shows, but kind of really getting his kind of hitting a stride. And considering, first of all, considering that he suffered from dyslexia and he had to write all this stuff with a typewriter, I can't imagine what that would be like. Even not having dyslexia and having just to use a typewriter to write, it's hard enough for me to write this show with a computer. Imagine writing under the pressure of having to write an episodic television show when you have to really concentrate super hard because your mind, you know, kind of mixes up letters sometimes. And you're also having to do it on typewriter. And the fact that that he was as prolific as he was throughout the 70s and 80s, creating shows, writing shows, just so much writing. It's crazy. I mean, just ridiculously successful. And that's amazing that he was able to do what he did. This episode was also the debut of Gretchen Corbett as Beth Davenport. As I mentioned earlier, she's going to appear in 33 episodes of this series between 1974 and 1978. She's also going to be in some of the TV, some or all of the TV movies that we will have to talk about years from now after we finish this. We're going to talk about all of these episodes eventually on this podcast. That's my goal. I'm certainly going to have to pick up the pace. I can't go 6 months between shows and then still talk about every episode of the Rockford Files, plus the TV movies at the end. I have my work cut out for me, but that's the plan. That's what we're going to do. Gretchen Corbett lives actually in Portland, Oregon, where she's from. She's actually appeared in 3 episodes of Portlandia, which I love. It's such a funny show. I've seen all the episodes. I don't necessarily remember. I'm going to have to go back and watch those episodes. I certainly didn't recognize her the first time I saw them. Anyway, that's The Dark and Bloody Ground. It took forever, but we've put another podcast together. I hope you enjoyed it. Before this show ends, I just like to mention something. The James Garner Animal Rescue Fund is the charity that's run by James' daughter, Gigi. You know, they help rescue and rehome animals, and that's a cause that's near and dear to my heart. So if you would like to support the James Garner Animal Rescue Fund, you can donate to them directly on their website at jgarf.org. We can also buy merch from them, like t-shirts, Rockford Files t-shirts and mugs and what have you. There's also another way you can donate kind of indirectly. The next time you buy something from Amazon, people buy stuff from Amazon all the time. Instead of typing www.amazon.com, type in smile.amazon.com, and then you can register with which charity you would like proceeds from your purchase to go to. You can do that with any charity of your choice. I would prefer what I do for me. And I think it'd be great if you love James Garner and you love animals, why not put the James Garner Animal Rescue Fund as your chosen charity on smile.amazon.com. Portion of the money you spend at Amazon will go to the fund. It's something you can do every time you shop at Amazon, and it doesn't cost you an extra penny. It comes literally out of Amazon's money, and they got plenty of it. So you know what? Let's make that happen. So please consider doing that. That's just something I think is very important. And who doesn't love James Garner and who doesn't love animals? So there you go. My rescue dog, Lucy, would thank you as well on behalf of some of her less fortunate animal friends. She's behind me on the bed here in the 853 OKG podcast world headquarters / bedroom. And she's looking at me because I'm the only one in the house and I'm talking to myself. She doesn't understand what's happening, but that's okay. That's it. That's the show, folks. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.